Today's Teisho will be on case 2 in the Heikigan Roku, the P and Mu. Case 2 is entitled Joshu's The Great Way Is Not Difficult. Engo's introduction. The universe is too narrow. The sun, moon, and stars are all at once darkened. Even if blows from the stick fall like raindrops, and the katsu shouts sound like thunder, you are still far short of the truth of Buddhism. Even if the Buddhas of the three worlds can only nod to themselves, and the patriarchs of all ages do not exhaustively demonstrate, even then the Buddhas of the three worlds can only nod to themselves, and the patriarchs of all ages do not exhaustively demonstrate its profundity. The whole treasury of sutras is inadequate to expound its meaning. Even the clearest-eyed monks fail to save themselves. At this point, how do you conduct yourself? Mentioning the name of the Buddha is like trudging through the mud. To utter the word Buddha, to utter the word Zen, is to cover your face with shame. Not only those who have long practiced Zen, but beginners too, should exert themselves to attain directly to the secret. Main subject. Joshu spoke to the assembly and he said, "The great way is not difficult. It only abhors choice and attachment. With but a single word there may arise choice and attachment, but there may arise clarity. This old monk does not have that clarity. Do you appreciate the meaning of this or not?" Then a monk asked, "If you do not have that clarity, what do you appreciate?" Joshu said, "I do not know that either." The monk said, "If you do not know, how can you say you do not have that clarity?" Joshu said, "Asking the question is good enough. Now make your bows and retire." Secho's verse. The real way is not difficult. Direct word, direct speech. One with many phases, two with one. Far away in the heavens, the sun rises, the moon sets. Beyond the hills, the high mountains, the cold waters. The skull has no consciousness, no delight. The dead tree sings in the wood, in the wind, not yet rotten. Difficult, difficult. Attachment and clarity. Watch and penetrate the secret. To thank you all for coming here today. This week, one of the members of our group told me about a personal crisis in his family. Turns out that a member of his family, actually a sister, is gay. And this has caused like an explosion in the family. And the parents are of two minds. Apparently the father is okay with this. The daughter came to see them and said, "Listen, I've got to share something with you. There's something you should know about me. I'm gay." And the father apparently said, "Okay." But for the mother, this was very difficult to deal with. Very, very upsetting, like really profoundly, deeply upsetting. You can imagine this recently, yesterday, the state of New Jersey voted down a gay marriage law. And that's really quite surprising because in many ways New Jersey is one of the most progressive states in the United States. I mean, even though you wouldn't guess this is the case from driving around on the turnpike and so on, we're actually the best educated state in the United States. Again, you'd never guess, you know, just walking around on the streets and so on, but we have the most educated citizenry of any of the states in America. And we are a pretty solidly democratic state. Not everybody who lives in New Jersey is proud of New Jersey. And The Sopranos is not necessarily good publicity for us. But all the same, we have very progressive legislation. Labor laws and other things actually the state of New Jersey is quite progressive. So it was a sort of a shock to me when I saw in the paper that this had been defeated, because I thought that we were in a good position to pass this law. This family is going through a crisis because the daughter has done something that I think takes a lot of courage. You know, very unusual for a young woman to have that kind of courage. You know, a lot of people would try to a lot of people would try to sidestep the problem, you know, the conflict, or you know, go away to college and have your relationships and then come home and sort of just be vague with everybody, you know. The mother might say, when are you going to bring home Mr. Wright, you know? And you could go, I don't know, one of these days, you know, in a million years, you know. Never, but you wouldn't say that, right? You'd think, one of these days, you know. And a lot of people, live that way. And so it takes a great deal. It's an unusual person who could say to her parents, you know, this is how it is with me, you know. For the mother, this was like a huge shock, you know, like stunning, like the ground had opened up, and like a disaster. I don't know these people, but maybe the mother was thinking, wedding day, wedding dress, you know, give daughter the something that her mother had given her. Now, you know, actually, if the state of New Jersey had passed this law, all of that could still happen, right? But not yet. And also, just the convention is, you know, a man and wife, right? And so now these people, mother might be thinking, no wedding day, no wedding dress, you know, no ritual, no grandchildren. Now even grandchildren are possible, right? But nevertheless, you know, the person is thinking these things, you know, because this is how it's always done.
I'm a certain age. I'm 56. When I was growing up, the gay liberation movement had started, you know, and friends I knew were gay, and it never caused me any problems, you know. But I think perhaps if I'd come from a different cultural background and so on, different tradition, you know, it might have been, if I were a parent and my child came in and said, I'm gay, I might be shocked, you know. So I mean, there are certainly things that could shock me. You know, I don't have kids, but if my son came in or my daughter came in and said, listen, I'm a Republican, you know. It might really rock my world, you know. I might really be stunned and horrified. You know. So it could happen. I could see it happening. You know? You know, this is something that's, it's difficult to deal with. And it's hard for people to be, to deal with this because, you know, it's complicated. Why is it so hard? You know, why is it so hard? I have known people who were gay who really spent a lot of time in the closet, you know, who really couldn't do it, you know. They couldn't go to their parents and say, this is who I am, you know. They couldn't do it. And it took years and years of pretending to be something they aren't, you know. And a lot of pain, a lot of personal pain. You might know that young gay people in the United States have very high suicide rate. You know? It's getting, hopefully, circumstances are changing, you know. But, when I was going to school, when I was in high school, you know, one of the worst insults was to call somebody a fag, right? That was like, and nobody wanted to be called that. That was the worst insult. So I can easily understand how if you grew up and you were a young man and you found yourself attracted to other men, you would really want to hide that from even yourself, you know. You'd definitely not want to deal with that. And it's a little different perhaps for women, but not much different, you know. So not only would you not want it to be public, but you really might not want to deal with it yourself. It might be something you want to put in a box and hide in your mind somewhere and not deal with it for a long time. This is very painful for people. It takes many years to work these things out. You know, shame is so powerful. The sense of shame. You think, where does that shame come from? For somebody like myself, it's not really a big problem if somebody's gay. You know, that's not a problem. It's okay. Many people would react very aggressively, very inhospitably to that news, you know. I think it's very hard for people to be natural, you know. And part of the reason it's so hard for people to be natural is because of these powerful social expectations, you know. And they're much more powerful, I think, than we realize, you know, or at least than I've often realized in my life. I've always been fascinated by the fact that it's difficult to practice Zazen on your own, especially when you're just a beginner, you know. So people will come here and they'll practice Zazen for the first time. You know, they'll be like a beginner. And I'll ask them, how did it go? And sometimes they'll say, oh, that went very well. Last night we had two new people. And I asked them, how did that go? And they said, this is great, you know, wonderful. And I said, well, please come back. And they said, oh, I will. Don't worry about that. You know, people say that all the time, you know, and they never come back. You know, maybe this is just not what they expected. You know, they looked on the website and they thought they would come to this very cool building, and it's just a room in Rutgers, and maybe it's just not what they wanted. They didn't want to come and do Zen in a tutoring center. They wanted to have a place that was very nice and so on. Who knows what they wanted, but sometimes they come and they have a good experience, and I always say, please go home and try to do this on your own. Try to do this a little bit on your own, but please come back here and practice. Now, some people do come back, and I'll ask them, how did it go at home? And sometimes they'll say, okay, and sometimes they'll tell me, you know, I didn't really sit at home, or I can't really sit by myself. And I've always thought that was odd, you know. But I think it's actually quite significant. I think it's very difficult for beginners to do this on their own. Isn't that interesting? Even if they read books about Zen, it's easier to read books about Zen than it is to practice Zen on your own. I think that's quite fascinating. It often happens that people come here to practice, and they start coming here for a while, and then they start finding a way to practice on their own. That's not uncommon. And I think it tells us a great deal about who we really are and how difficult it is to be true to our true nature, you know. It's not, in other words, trivial that people find it so hard to practice on their own. It's not simply that they are lazy or undisciplined. I think that there's much more to it than that, you know. I think part of it is that this practice is not part of the reality of our society, you know. So, as I often tell beginners, you never drive down a street in New Jersey and see a billboard that says, "Pursue enlightenment." Right? It's just not a part of our reality. If this were Tibet or certain parts of the world, there'd be a temple every so many thousand people, and there'd be statues of Guanyin or Buddha, and all of these things would remind you that this is real, this is important. You might have members of your family who were monks or nuns, and all of this would say, this is real, this is real. You know. I think we are much more susceptible. You know, Americans imagine, we like to think of ourselves as these incredible individualists, you know, where, you know, movies always often show a hero who goes against the tide, you know. The hero is somebody who thinks for himself. And, you know, typically, like if it's a cop movie, the chief will say, "Whatever you do, don't do this." And the guy will walk out with a smirk and he'll do exactly what the chief said not to do, right? You know, that's a classic. This is probably before your time, but there was a movie with Eddie Murphy called Beverly Hills Cop. And Eddie Murphy was this wise-cracking individualist, right? So, you know, people tell him, "Don't do this," and he just does what he knows he has to do, right? And this is sort of like a fantasy in our minds as Americans. We deeply want to think that we're like that, you know. Another version of this is the reporter who gets to the heart of the story, you know. The reporter who there was a famous movie long ago called All the President's Men. And it's about two investigative journalists who cracked the Watergate case, see, and they just keep going and going. But, you know, actually, most journalists aren't like that. Most policemen aren't like Eddie Murphy, you know. Most people don't do what they're not supposed to do. This is actually the case, you know. And it's not fear. It has to do, I think, a lot with, you know, as we're growing up, we look to other people for our cues about who we should be and what we should do. And we're very dependent on our image in the eyes of others. You know, this is actually quite normal. You know, babies, first relationship of a baby is with its mother. And I've been fascinated by this for many years, you know, how babies interact with their mothers. I have a couple books on it. And it turns out that the very, very deep communication goes on between a baby and the mother. And, you know, the baby is constantly, studies show that the baby is constantly watching the mother's eyes. So, you know, babies are very, very attuned to mom. And they watch mother's eyes, and if the mother's eyes alight on the baby's eyes light up too, you know. So the baby's constantly trying to make contact with mom. And the baby's also following mother's eyes. So when mother looks at something, the baby will look at it too. The baby learns how to value things by watching what the mother values. And so if the mother sees something and her face lights up, the baby's face lights up. See? So the baby learns this is good, this I should be afraid of this, you know, I should be distressed by this, by imitating mom. And there's no other way to learn, right? So this is the trusted person. And you take your cue from the trusted person who you have an unconditional relationship with. And so, you know, if the mother it responds to your unhappiness by becoming attentive, that's a bonding moment. Mm-hmm. If the mother responds to you in a way that makes you happy and your eyes meet, then that's a bonding moment. And you gradually learn how to understand the world by using your mother as a bridge into the world, you know. And this relationship, if it's a healthy one, gives people the confidence to begin to explore the world on their own, you know. I think that our relationship with other people is often like this, you know. When we find people we admire or respect, we try to take our cue from them, you know. You know, I've talked about this before, but when I first came to Rutgers, there was a very famous professor named Richard Poirier, who recently died. And Poirier was from Maine, actually. He was from Maine. And he had an incredible New England accent. It was an awful accent. And he used to say the word modern. Modern. He would say modern world. So here in the modern world, I heard him say modern, and I thought, what is he talking? The modern. What could that be? You know? The modern. And then I realized he's saying modern. The modern world. Okay. So, you know, when I first got to Rutgers, I would actually hear graduate students who weren't from the coast fishing villages in Maine go, the Morden, you know. And I thought, what the hell is going on? But they were imitating a trusted authority, you know. This is what they did, you know. And this is very human. This is, we take our cue from other people. Right, you know, there's no other way to learn how to be human, because a human is an invention. It's like a collective dream. You know, there's a kind of collective dream, and in that collective dream, which we call culture or society, we learn how to be real by imitating others. You know. So it takes a lot of courage for a young girl to go to her parents and say, even though you are my trusted guides in life, there's something that I can't, I have to tell you that you're not going to like. That's very, very difficult, you know. And it takes a lot of personal courage. And it's rather unusual to see somebody have that kind of determination at so young an age, because generally speaking, that creates a tremendous conflict inside of you, you know. The issue might not be your sexual orientation. It could be many things, you know. But generally speaking, things are not real until other people's eyes light up for us, right? And I think this is part of the reason why it's so hard for people to do Zen practice on their own. It isn't quite real, you know. It's very interesting, you know. When I first started doing Zen practice, I actually did it on my own because I wasn't, I was so isolated. There was no, I read books on Zen, and I was in, I guess I was in college, and I started trying to meditate on my own. When I started going to the Seattle Zen Center and training with Genki Roshi, then I had this behavior where I would come home and say, I'm going to sit today. But some days I wouldn't sit. You know, I'd say, I'm going to sit today, but then I'd get up and think, oh, it's a little later than I planned, you know, I'll do it tonight. And then tonight would come, but I had to read my stuff for graduate school or grade my papers, and then that day would be gone. And then the next day I'd say, well, I'll do it tomorrow, but I wouldn't do it tomorrow, you know. And if somebody had said, do you want to do meditation, I would say, oh, yes, very much. This is very interesting to me. But for some reason, I couldn't get on the cushion. And I think part of it is this issue of what's real. You know, we take our cue much more than we realize from the society. Even if we don't think, you know, we want to see ourselves as like these individualists who think for themselves and so on. But even when you think for yourself, you tend to think for yourself in very conventional ways, you know. And so it's very hard. I think there's a real struggle getting to the cushion because it has to do with our, not just our relationship to society, but our relationship to ourself, you know. It's very difficult to be truthful with ourselves. It's very difficult to have a kind of, you know, Zen is like a special relationship to society. And it's like a special relationship to yourself. And it's difficult. Because, you know, when you sit down on the cushion, in a way, you're saying to the whole world, goodbye for a while, right? You're sitting down by yourself, and you're really by yourself. It might be the only time during the whole day that you're really by yourself. See, because, you know, I myself am not always by myself, you know. So, for example, you know, when I drove over here, I turned on a radio. And I was listening to one of my favorite shows, Living on Earth, which is an environmental program. And they had some fascinating material. And sadly, one of the biologists they interviewed said, there's really no hope for the polar bear. You know, the polar bear, this woman said, is really doomed. And that's really heartbreaking, isn't it? But anyway, you know, I was listening to all this, and I was getting mad, and I was, you know, worried. And I, in other words, I was experiencing all of this with the people on the radio. And I was rehearsing conversations with people I know, and so on. So I wasn't alone, you know. And you know, at home, even when you're by yourself, sometimes you're not alone. You know, you're reading, and so you're having a conversation with the author, or you're thinking. And when you're thinking, you know, actually you're not necessarily alone either, you know. So when you sit down on the cushion, you really are alone in a very profound way, you know. And it's something, it's you know, it's easy to jog, you know. I mean, if people decide they're going to jog, it's actually much easier to say, okay, I'm going to jog every other day than it is to say I'm going to meditate every other day. Because, you know, when you jog, you're doing something that is conventionally approved of by society. People say, oh, you're out jogging, that's very good for you, you know, good boy, you know. When you sit down on your cushion, you know, that's very strange in the context of our culture, first of all. You don't get the cultural approval. In fact, people may even disapprove of it. There are many people who see meditation as narcissistic and world-evading. Members of my own family felt that way. My father used to belittle meditation. He used to call it navel gazing. So you're staring at your navel again, huh? My father meant that this is a useless activity. Many people would feel that way. I mean, meditation gets very good press now from the sciences, right? So every day you'll read some new stuff on meditation and depression, or meditation and the brain. And it's science, so it's real, right? So it becomes real. But nevertheless, for many people, meditation is not like socially approved of. If you go to somebody and you say, I'm going to go to graduate school so I can study business administration or medicine, they go, oh, it's wonderful. You say, well, I might be going to do meditation in a retreat. You know, they might think that's a little odd, you know. So that's part of the picture, but part of the picture is also just, you know, it takes great courage to sit down on the cushion and really be alone. And many people are afraid to be alone, you know, in that way. You know, you don't have to go up into the mountains and be a recluse to be alone. When you sit down on the cushion, you know, really and truly, there's a kind of direct, you're really facing yourself in a direct way. And it could seem trivial, but it's not trivial. So when people come in, beginners come in to meditate, you know, they sit down on the cushion and they might be expecting like bliss, right? So I'm going to come in, I'm going to sit down on the cushion and I'm going to enter bliss. And they come in, they sit down on the cushion, and the first thing they notice is that they're very, very tense. And the tension seems worse than before they started meditating. Maybe this could happen, right? Or maybe you sit down and you realize you're afraid. Or maybe you realize you're angry. See? And these are not necessarily things people want to notice about themselves. So you know, if every time you sit down to meditate, you become aware of how hungry you are for affection, or how fearful you are, or how disappointed you feel. You know, it takes a lot of courage to get back on the cushion and deal with those emotions. You know, that takes a lot of courage. It's much easier, in a certain sense, not to do that. Right? It would be easier just to have a drink, or go shoot some baskets, or go jogging. So Zen is really quite challenging. You know, other meditation traditions give you things to do, you know. So there are other meditation traditions where they say, you know, let's visualize a deity. You know, this is like a Tibetan Buddhism, you know. Like you might visualize a deity, or you might recite a lot of prayers, or do a lot of prostrations, and there's nothing wrong with that. But Zen is often thought of as the most direct path. You know, of all the Buddhist paths, Zen is the most direct. So you know, you come in and the teacher says, watch your breath, and you become aware right away that you're anxious or fearful. Or you become aware that you're very, very needy. Or you become aware that you're maybe you become aware that you're gay, right? And it might be something you didn't necessarily want to be aware of. So Zen takes a lot of courage, and people can be scared to sit on that cushion. You know, Zen people come to a Zen because they're interested in bliss, you know, interested in bliss. And they want to have, like, a happy life. They want to look like the Dalai Lama, smiling and so on. And you know, that is the goal of Zen, but we all have obstacles that we have to work through, and we all have things about ourselves we have to confront. And so I think it's very difficult for beginners to sit down on the cushion for all of these reasons. You know, I think it's very complicated. Sitting on that cushion is not a simple thing. You think, what could be more simple? Just sit down and meditate, right? Why am I postponing this? You know, I'll even clean the bathroom rather than sitting. Why? Now, I myself love Zazen, but I didn't always love Zazen. It was often a struggle to sit down on the cushion. I get up every day and I do my Zazen and I love it. But there's a certain kind of relationship with the self. You know, it's like truth-telling time. And it's very difficult, you know, at times. We would prefer not to deal with these things, right? I think that Zazen is a lot like analysis, you know. When I was a little boy, I did analysis with a wonderful psychiatrist named Dr. Kriegman. And I would go to Dr. Kriegman, and he would just, you know, he would say, well, how's it going? And, okay. Any problems? No. Yeah. But then after a while, you know, something would come up, you know, and I suddenly realized that I was very upset or very afraid. And you know, Zazen can be like that, too. You say, oh, I'll sit down. I'll do my Zazen. You know, I'm watching the breath. Nothing's happening. Boy, this is really boring, you know. And, you know, that's funny. You know, like psychiatrists must have jokes about, how's it going? Oh, fine, right? So, you know, how come you slashed your wrist? You know, how come you, you know, so there must be, you know, we don't want ourselves to see certain things, you know. So, you know, we sit down on the cushion and we say, how's it going, Kurt? Oh, fine, you know. But it's not fine, right? And you think, this is boring, you know. But all of a sudden you realize, gee, I'm actually afraid. I'm fearful. Or I'm angry, or whatever, you know. Or you're having fantasies, and you think, why am I having these stupid fantasies, you know? Little by little, it's like you confront things. And sometimes, you know, sometimes there seems to be nothing there, but sometimes there's something there. If you do enough Zazen, you know, you really get down into these deep obstacles. You know, and koans help so much, right? Koans are great because, you know, if you sit on the cushion, sometimes you think, well, I have nothing to report. Everything's just serene, you know, and then you give somebody a koan and they want to throw a chair against the wall, you know. And you say, I thought you were serene, you know. So there's some blockage, some obstacle. You know, koans are these wonderful devices for finding our inner obstacles, you know. So sitting on the cushion is a very courageous act, and it's something that people have a hard time doing on their own initially. And so it's actually very good to have a sangha. It's very good, you know. The sangha is so important, not, you know, for many reasons. I mean, actually, it's just healthy for people to have to have associations with other people. You know. They find that people who live a long time and are happy have rich social lives. And so just being part of something like this is good for you, you know. But there's a deeper dimension to this, because this is like people who are coming here, all doing this together, and this is saying, this is real. This is real. You know, it's as real as graduate school. It's as real as working at a bank. You know? It's real. And there's a part of us that doesn't believe that, you know, because you don't see the billboards. You don't get the message, you know, from the society that waking up is worth doing. So that's a real obstacle. When you come here and you're encountering other people with these noble intentions, it reminds you that this is real. And that's very important. There are a very, very rarely you will meet people who wake up by themselves. In Buddhist literature, these people are called solitary Buddhas. Yeah. There are very rarely solitary Buddhas, but they're very, you know, so rare. Even the Buddha, even Siddhartha, did not awaken by himself. You know, he practiced with the forest-dwelling rishis, and then he became a student of the two really greatest meditation masters of his time. And he practiced with both of them until he had exhausted what they had to teach. He went to study with the first one, and the first one taught Mushin, basically. The first one taught Shunyata, basically. And then the second teacher taught a state of a consciousness beyond Shunyata. And the Buddha, after working with each teacher, decided that this was not Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, not absolute awakening. And went on, and finally he exhausted the teachers he had studied with. But then he was still practicing before his enlightenment with, they're often called the five companions. The Buddha had five friends, and they were all practicing together, trying to achieve highest awakening. And only at the very end did the Buddha go off by himself. They were all into fasting and mortifying the flesh, as we say in the West. So the Buddha tried fasting until he almost died. And then he left his five companions, and he went and had some rice, actually some yogurt and some rice, some peasant girl gave him. And then he sat back down and he said, I'll give this one more try. You know? And then he had his Daikensho experience. And then he went back to see his five friends, and they all said, you know, look at you. You've obviously had something to eat, you big hypocrite. Really, that's what this says in the sutras. It's interesting. After the Buddha's enlightenment, First of all, he runs into somebody he knew before, who is also a great meditation teacher. And the Buddha says, I have awakened fully. I have achieved Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. And the guy goes, oh, that's nice. In other words, I don't believe you. Isn't that interesting? The first person he meets just says, yeah, I don't think so. So long. And then the Buddha goes and meets his five companions, and he says, I have a way. They say, buddy, pal, we're glad you're back. And the Buddha says, please don't call me buddy anymore. Please call me the Tathagata, because I have had Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. I have awakened enlightenment without remainder. And they say, oh, sure, yeah, sure. But he talks to them for a while, and they think, you know, maybe you have, you know. And that's how it works out in the sutra. So only at the very end does the Buddha go off by himself. And the point is, you know, we need a sangha. We need to practice with structure. We need a guidance. You know, even today I talk to my teachers. You know, I don't really talk to Genki Roshi, but I regularly speak to Webb. And Webb would go back to Japan every year and train with the Morinaga Soko Roshi until Morinaga died. So it's very important to have this structure, because it's so difficult to be really alone. Really alone. That's very, very difficult, right? You only can wake up when you're alone. Nobody can wake up for you, and there's no such thing as collective enlightenment. So there's a moment at which you really have to be totally alone, alone with the alone. You know, as one person once put it, you have to be alone with the alone, capital A. You have to be just yourself with the just with itself, you know. And that is a most intimate experience, right? But that takes many years of preparation, and it takes a whole structure to make that possible. So basically, it's unusual for a young girl who's 17 to be able to say to her parents, "I'm not what you want me to be." Even though that's a big struggle for her, and even though her mother has gone off the deep end, everybody's going to get over it. And it will be so wonderful, maybe, if this girl someday can come home and say, "This is my partner in life. She too is a woman like me." And it would be so wonderful if the parents could say, "Oh, we're so happy to meet you." See, then everybody can be natural. See, so hard to be natural. Very difficult. Americans think they're natural, but give me a break, right? Hardly. Much of what we do is learned by seeking the approval of others, and again, that's a human thing. But the highest awareness requires us to be alone with the alone. And that's very difficult, When I answered the Mu Koan, I was blocked for many, many years. I couldn't even open my mouth sometime to call Mu in the Dokusan room. And when I had really given up and thought I was just going to be this colossal Zen failure, I went to some sesshin, and I really just dropped deeply into Mu, and I went into the kitchen where we had Dokusan at our temple. And I opened my mouth, and this huge thing came out. I didn't try at all. I just opened my mouth, and Mu came out. And I thought, damn, where did that come from? And Genki Roshi laughed, and he said, "Not bad, He said, "How do you feel?" And when I asked myself, "How do I feel?" I felt totally alone. And I told Genki, "I feel alone," and he burst into laughter. But it's hard to be alone with the true, we say the true self. But when we're alone with the true self, after we've cut through all the layers of pretend, and we encounter our true self, the most amazing thing happens. You say, "Oh my gosh, I'm not ashamed anymore. I'm not afraid anymore. I'm not anxious. And I actually love myself," And there, I believe that not one in a thousand persons really loves herself. I think it's very difficult to love yourself. In the West, in say Christian tradition, you're told love other people. And eventually, the emphasis is on the ability to love others, and that's very important. So I'm not criticizing it. But in Buddhism, the problem is not that we can't love others. We often can't love others, but the reason is that basically we're so ashamed. We're so ashamed of ourselves. And we really don't like ourselves, at all. Because we're not Albert Einstein, we're not Thomas Pynchon, we're not, whatever. We have we always have these ego ideals, right? These people we wanted to be like. But you can't ever be like anyone else. You can't. So we have the ego ideal. Maybe you meet a professor in college and you think, "I want to be like him," and then you get to be a professor and you realize, "Oh, I'm such a phony," Because you're not like him. You tried to be like him, but you're not, And people can put on robes and also be phony. You can put on robes and say, "Now I'm finally like Genki Roshi." But you're still pretending. It's very difficult to love ourselves because we can't ever live up to our ego ideal. You know, those people we wanted to be like, we can never be like them. Never. And so we're always in this condition of being unnatural. Unnatural. Pretending to be someone we aren't. Trying so hard. You know, being such good boys and such good girls, you know. But every once in a while, it's possible for us to be natural. You know, sometimes we do things that we really like. We're not doing them because other people want us to do them. We're doing them because it's what we really like. You know, sometimes if we're very lucky, we can line up what we really like with our job. You know, that would be great, right? Suddenly you're doing something that you really like, no matter what, you know. Somehow you're able to be yourself, you know. What could be easier? You know, that means I be myself, I'll put my feet up on the table, and that's not being yourself, right? It's very difficult to be yourself because it's very difficult to be alone with the self, you know. That's why people go to psychiatrists, right? Because it's so hard to be alone with the self. You know, often people will analyze themselves when they're with psychiatrists, you know. But they don't, it's hard to do that on your own. It's frightening, right? And so having somebody there to like bear witness to this is helpful. Also having somebody there to ratify it, you know. To say, okay, well, you're not crazy. That's all right to feel that way. And Zen is a little tougher than that because you do it on yourself. You do it by yourself, right? So it's a little harder. But the more we are alone with the self, you know, the more honest we can be. And eventually, you realize, you know, I actually don't hate myself. I actually love myself. You know, and there's just at some point, if you practice Zen long enough, there's like a generalized love, right? One person once told me she was in public and she looked over at somebody's face and just felt total love. This is somebody who's been practicing for 10 years, doing Zen for about 10 years now. And she said she was in public somewhere and she looked at somebody's face and was shocked to feel this outpouring of love for a total stranger. You know, and it's, believe it or not, it's even possible to feel that love for yourself. It's just like you suddenly realize you look at yourself as though from a distance. And you go, oh, you poor kid, you know, you've been trying so hard. You've been such a good girl, you've been such a good boy. You've been trying so hard to do what's expected. And you've been so ashamed for so long. And you know, I really think you're okay. I really think you're okay. You know, that moment is the most precious moment. You could please everybody else, but if that moment hasn't come, you're still in chains. You know? And so when it comes, it's very nice, very lovely. Joshu was such a person, you know. He had been alone. Joshu had his Daikensho when he was 17. He had a big enlightenment, not Daikensho, but a big enlightenment when he was just 17, right? And the teacher said, "How do you feel?" And he said, "I feel like I'm ruined and alone, like a ruined house. I feel like a ruined house." You know, and you can think, "Oh, that sounds terrible," but Joshu meant the roof has been blown off, the walls are gone. I'm just sitting here without my clothes on, you know. That's what he meant. I'm naked, right? I'm like a house without a roof. You know, there's no walls, there's nothing to hide, it's all blown away. If Joshua had been a modern American, he would have written a book and marketed it on Oprah. And it would have been called The No Roof, No Walls Way, or Totally Naked, How to Accept Yourself, right? But instead, Joshu said, I would like to deepen this practice. And he deepened it for 100 years. He lived to be like 120. So Joshu practiced Zazen for 100 years. Think of that. I hope I can practice Zazen for 100 years. I really do. And I wish I could live for 200 years just to keep doing this. But anyway, Joshu had that experience, and he deepened it, and deepened it, and deepened it, and deepened it. So, you know, by the time Joshu was like an old man, it was like there was nothing embarrassed. You know, it's like, you know, if you go to Sesshin, you know, when you go to the bathroom, you don't want to fart. You know, you want to go in and sit down on the can and just quietly go to the bathroom. And at some point, you're going to fart, you know. And it's embarrassing, or at least it is to me. You know, it's like, now everybody knows I fart, you know. Good God. Oh, well. And then you go, okay, doesn't everybody, right? But there's a moment there where it's embarrassing, because you're not supposed to fart in public. But actually, in the bathroom, that's where you're supposed to fart. But it's public if other people are there. So it's like a contradiction, right? We have around the body many prohibitions that are elemental prohibitions, you know. And they're very, we learned them before we could even speak, right? So you know, they're very, cause a lot of deep anxiety, you know. So it's trivial, but not trivial. But, you know, actually, after everybody's heard you fart, you can relax, right? It's not a problem anymore, you know. Joshu was like that in every way, you know. It's like just not worried, not worried. You know, there's a wonderful picture of Zen monk. You know, you'll see statues of Zen monk. You know, if you go into a Chinese restaurant, sometimes you'll see a monk on the counter with a big fat belly hanging out. And basically, he's smiling and he's happy, and it's like he's not worried about his weight. He's not worried about being handsome or attractive. He's not worried about anything. His heart is just full of love, and he's accepted himself, right? He's gone right to the core of the self, and he knows, I'm okay with all of this, you know, my big belly, my bald head, you know, and so on. So Joshu was like that, totally natural. Uwei, Uwei. Joshu spoke to the assembly and he said, the great way is not difficult. It only abhors choice and attachment. But with a single word, there may arise choice and attachment, or there may arise clarity. Anyway, and the monk says, well, you're still stuck with choice and attachment, right? And because you're attached to being not attached, you know, or some crap like that. You know. And Joshu just says, look, you know, please go sit by yourself and be alone. Joshu says, asking the question is good enough. Now make your bows and retire, right? He says, good, good, you're a good, he actually says, good boy. You're such a good boy, you're doing just what you're supposed to do. You're doing just what you've been trained to do, you've been taught to do. You're giving me a hard time, right? Good. That's what you've been taught to do. Now, go sit down on your cushion and be alone with the alone. See? So go, he's good, good. Now make your bows and retire. So he's not just saying, shut up and get out. See, that's not what he's saying. He's saying, please now go to the cushion and face yourself. Right? Now go, and you tell me if you are, tell me if you're able to have no preferences, right? No difficulty. Setcho's verse, the real way, the great way is not difficult. For those who have no preferences, direct word, direct speech, natural, not okay. One with many phases, two with one.
far away in the heavens the sun rises, the moon sets. Beyond the hills, the high mountains, the cold waters. All of this is just unfolding as it has to unfold. The skull has no consciousness, no delight. The dead tree sings in the wind. When you're really free from all of these obstacles, it's like the winds of heaven can blow through your empty skull, and that's a beautiful feeling. Difficult. Attachment and clarity. Watch and penetrate the secret.